husband of the Catalan, Mercedes. "Ah, sir," cried the Countess, "how terrible a vengeance for a fault which fatality made me commit! For I am the only culprit, Edmund, and if you owe revenge to anyone, it is to me, who had not fortitude to bear your absence and my solitude." "But," exclaimed Monte Cristo, "why was I absent, and why were you alone?" "Because you had been arrested, Edmund, and were a prisoner." "And why was I arrested? Why was I a prisoner?" "I do not know," said Mercedes. "You do not, madame. At least, I hope not. But I will tell you. I was arrested and became a prisoner because, under the arbor of La Réserve, the day before I was to marry you, a man named Danglars wrote this letter, which the fisherman Fernand himself posted." Monte Cristo went to a secretaire, opened a drawer by a spring, from which he took a paper which had lost its original color, and the ink of which had become a rusty hue. This he placed in the hands of Mercedes. It was Danglars' letter to the Procureur du Roi, which the Count of Monte Cristo, disguised as a clerk from the house of Thompson and French, had taken from the bundle of Edmond Dantès on the day he had paid the 200,000 francs to Monsieur de Beauvie. Mercedes read with terror the following lines: "The Procureur du Roi is informed by a friend to the throne and the religious institutions of his country that an individual named Edmond Dantès, second in command on board the Pharaon, this day arrived from Smyrna after having touched at Naples and Porto Ferrajo, has been the bearer of a letter from Murat to the usurper, and again taken charge of another letter from the usurper to the Bonapartist Club in Paris. Ample corroboration of this statement may be obtained by arresting the above-mentioned Edmond Dantès, who either carries the letter for Paris about with him, or has it at his father's abode. Should it not be found in possession of either father or son, then it will assuredly be discovered in the cabin belonging to the said Dantès on board the Pharaon."
"How dreadful!" said Mercedes, passing her hand across her brow, moist with perspiration. "And that letter?"
"I bought it for 200,000 francs, madame," said Monte Cristo, "but that is a trifle, since it enables me to justify myself to you."
"And the result of that letter?"
"You well know, madame, was my arrest. But you do not know how long that arrest lasted. You do not know that I remained for 14 years within a quarter of a league of you, in a dungeon in the Chateau d'If. You do not know that each day of those 14 years I renewed the vow of vengeance which I had made the first day. And yet I knew not you had married Fernand, my calumniator, and that my father had died of hunger."
"Can it be?" cried Mercedes, shuddering. "That is what I heard on leaving my prison 14 years after I had entered it, and that is why, on account of the living Mercedes and my deceased father, I have sworn to revenge myself on Fernand, and I have revenged myself."
"And you are sure the unhappy Fernand did that?" "I am satisfied, madame. He did what I have told you. Besides, that is not much more odious than a Frenchman by adoption having passed over to the English, a Spaniard by birth having fought against the Spaniards, a stipendiary of Ali having betrayed and murdered Ali. Compared with such things, what is the letter you have just read? A lover's deception, which the woman who has married that man ought certainly to forgive, but not so the lover who was to have married her. Well, the French did not avenge themselves on the traitor. The Spaniards did not shoot the traitor. Ali in his tomb left the traitor unpunished. But I, betrayed, sacrificed, buried, have risen from my tomb by the grace of God to punish that man. He sends me for that purpose.
and here I am." The poor woman's head and arms fell. Her legs bent under her, and she sank on her knees. "Forgive, Edmund. Forgive, for my sake, who loves you still." The dignity of the wife stopped the enthusiasm of the lover and the mother. Her forehead almost touched the carpet when the Count sprang forward and raised her. Then, seated on a chair, she looked at the manly countenance of Monte Cristo, on which grief and hatred still impressed a threatening expression. "Not crush that accursed race," murmured he. "Abandon my purpose at the moment of its accomplishment?" "Impossible, madame, impossible." "Edmund," said the poor mother, who tried every means, "when I call you Edmund, why do you not call me Mercedes?"
"Mercedes," repeated Monte Cristo. "Mercedes. Yes. Yes, you are right. That name has still its charms, and this is the first time for a long period that I have pronounced it so distinctly. Oh, Mercedes, I have uttered your name with the sigh of melancholy, with the groan of sorrow, with the last effort of despair. I have uttered it when frozen with cold, crouched on the straw in my dungeon. I have uttered it consumed with heat, rolling on the stone floor of my prison. Mercedes, I must revenge myself, for I suffered 14 years. 14 years I wept, I cursed. Now I tell you, Mercedes, I must revenge myself." The Count, fearing to yield to the entreaties of her he had so ardently loved, recalled his sufferings to the assistance of his hatred. "Revenge yourself then, Edmund," cried the poor mother, "but let your vengeance fall on the culprits, on him, on me, but not on my son." Monte Cristo groaned and seized his beautiful hair with both hands. "Edmund," continued Mercedes, with her arms extended towards the Count, "since I first knew you, I have adored your name, have respected your memory. Edmund, my friend, do not compel me to tarnish that noble and fine image reflected incessantly on the mirror of my heart. Edmund, if you knew all the prayers I have addressed to God for you while I thought you were living, and since I have thought you must be dead. Yes, dead, alas. I thought your dead body was buried at the foot of some gloomy tower. I thought your corpse was precipitated to the bottom of one of those gulfs where jailers roll their dead prisoners. And I wept. What could I do for you, Edmund, besides pray and weep? Listen, during 10 years I dreamed each night the same dream. I had been told you had endeavoured to escape, that you had taken the place of another prisoner, that you had slipped into the winding sheet of a dead body, that you had been precipitated alive from the top of the Chateau d'If, and the cry you uttered as you dashed upon the rocks first revealed to your jailers that they were your murderers. Well, Edmund, I swear to you by the head of that son for whom I entreat your pity. Edmund, during 10 years I have seen every night men balancing something shapeless and unknown at the top of a rock. During 10 years I have heard each night a terrible cry which has awoke me shuddering and cold. And I too, Edmund, oh believe me, guilty as I was, oh yes, I too have suffered much.
Have you felt your father die in your absence? Cried Monte Cristo, again thrusting his hands in his hair. Have you seen the woman you loved giving her hand to your rival while you were perishing at the bottom of a dungeon?
No, interrupted Mercedes, but I have seen him whom I loved on the point of murdering my son. Mercedes pronounced these words with such deep anguish, with an accent of such intense despair, that Monte Cristo could not restrain a sob. The lion was daunted. The avenger was conquered. "What do you ask of me?" said he. "Your son's life? Well, he shall live." Mercedes uttered a cry which made the tears start from Monte Cristo's eyes. "Oh," said she, seizing the Count's hand and raising it to her lips. "Oh, thank you. Thank you, Edmund. Now you are exactly what I dreamt you were, such as I always loved you. Oh, now I may say so."
"So much the better," replied Monte Cristo, "as that poor Edmund will not have long to be loved by you. Death is about to return to the tomb, the phantom to retire in darkness."
"What do you say, Edmund?"
"I say, since you command me, Mercedes, I must die."
"Die? And who told you so? Who talks of dying? Whence have you these ideas of death?"
"You do not suppose that publicly, outraged in the face of a whole theatre, in the presence of your friends and those of your son, challenged by a boy who will glory in my pardon as in a victory, you do not suppose I can for one moment wish to live? What I most loved after you, Mercedes, was myself, my dignity, and that strength which rendered me superior to other men. That strength was my life. With one word you have crushed it, and I die."
"But the duel will not take place, Edmund, since you forgive."
"It will take place," said Monte Cristo, in a most solemn tone. "But instead of your son's blood, which will stain the ground, mine will flow." Mercedes shrieked and sprang towards Monte Cristo, but suddenly stopping,
"Edmund," said she, "there is a God above us. Since you live, since I have seen you again, I trust to him from my heart. While waiting his assistance, I trust to your word. You have said my son should live, have you not?"
"Yes, madame, he shall live," said Monte Cristo, surprised that without more emotion Mercedes had accepted the heroic sacrifice he made for her. Mercedes extended her hand to the Count.
"Edmund," said she, and her eyes were wet with tears while looking at him to whom she spoke, "how noble it is of you, how great the action you have just performed, how sublime to have taken pity on a poor woman who offered herself to you with every chance against her. Alas, I am grown old with grief more than with years, and cannot now remind my Edmund by a smile or by a look of that Mercedes whom he once spent so many hours in contemplating. Ah, believe me, Edmund, I told you I too had suffered much. I repeat it, it is melancholy to pass one's life without having one joy to recall, without preserving a single hope. But that proves that all is not yet over. No, it is not finished. I feel it by what remains in my heart. Oh, I repeat it, Edmund, what you have just done is beautiful. It is grand. It is sublime."
"Do you say so now, Mercedes? And what would you say if you knew the extent of the sacrifice I make to you? But no, no, you cannot imagine what I lose in sacrificing my life at this moment." Mercedes looked at the Count with an air which depicted at the same time her astonishment, her admiration, and her gratitude. Monte Cristo pressed his forehead on his burning hands, as if his brain could no longer bear alone the weight of its thoughts.
"Edmund," said Mercedes, "I have but one word more to say to you."
The Count smiled bitterly.
"Edmund," continued she, "you will see if my face is pale, if my eyes are dull, if my beauty is gone, if Mercedes, in short, no longer resembles her former self in her features. You will see her heart is still the same. Adieu, then, Edmund. I have nothing more to ask of heaven. I have seen you again, and have found you as noble and as great as formerly you were. Adieu, Edmund. Adieu." and thank you."
But the Count did not answer. Mercedes opened the door of the cabinet and had disappeared before he had recovered from the painful and profound reverie into which his thwarted vengeance had plunged him. The clock of the Invalides struck one when the carriage which conveyed Madame de Morcerf away rolled on the pavement of the Champs-Élysées and made Monte Cristo raise his head.
91. The Meeting.
After Mercedes had left Monte Cristo, a gloomy shadow seemed to overspread everything. Around him and within him, the flight of thought appeared stopped. His energetic mind slumbered, as does the body after extreme fatigue. "What?" said he to himself, while the lamp and the wax lights were nearly burnt out, and the servants were waiting impatiently in the anteroom. "What? This edifice which I have been so long preparing, which I have reared with so much care and toil, is to be crumbled by a single touch, a word, even a slight breath? Yes, this self of whom I thought so much, of whom I was so proud, who had appeared so worthless in the dungeons of the Château d'If, and whom I had succeeded in making so great, will be but a lump of clay tomorrow. Alas, it is not the death of the body I regret, for is not that destruction of the vital principle the rest to which everything is tending, to which every unhappy being aspires, the repose of matter after which I so long sighed, and which I was seeking to attain by the painful process of starvation when Faria appeared in my dungeon? What is death for me but one step more towards repose? No, it is not existence then that I regret, but the ruin of my projects so slowly carried out, so laboriously framed. Providence is now opposed to them, when I most thought it would be propitious. It is not God's will they should be accomplished. This burden, almost as heavy as a world which I had raised and had thought to bear to the end, was too great for my strength, and I was compelled to lay it down in the middle of my career. Oh, shall I then again become a fatalist, whom 14 years of despair and 10 of hope had rendered a believer in Providence? And all this because my heart, which I thought dead, was only sleeping, because it has awoke and has beaten again, because I have yielded to the pain of the emotion excited in my breast by a woman's voice. Yet, continued the Count, becoming each moment more absorbed in the anticipation of the dreadful sacrifice for the morrow which Mercedes had accepted, yet it is impossible that so noble-minded a woman should thus, through selfishness, consent to my death, when in the prime of life and strength. It is impossible she can carry to such a point maternal love, or rather delirium. There are virtues which become crimes by exaggeration. No, she must have conceived some pathetic scene. She will come and throw herself between us, and what would be sublime here will appear there ridiculous. The blush of pride mounted to the Count's forehead as this thought passed through his mind. Folly, folly, folly! To carry generosity so far as to place myself as a mark for that young man to aim at. He will never believe my death was a suicide, and yet it is important for the honour of my memory, and this surely is not vanity, but a justifiable pride. It is important the world should know that I have consented by my free will to stop my arm already raised to strike, and that with that arm, so powerful against others, I have struck myself. It must be. It shall be. Seizing a pen, he drew a paper from a secret drawer in his bureau, and traced at the bottom of that paper, which was no other than his will, made since his arrival in Paris, a sort of codicil
clearly explaining the nature of his death. "I do this, O my God," said he, with his eyes raised to heaven, "as much for thy honour as for mine. I have, during 10 years, considered myself the agent of thy vengeance, and other wretches like Morcerf, Adangla, Avifor, even that Morcerf himself, must not imagine that chance has freed them from their enemy. Let them know, on the contrary, that their punishment which has been decreed by Providence is only delayed by my present determination, that although they escape it in this world, it awaits them in another, and that they are only exchanging time for eternity." While he was thus agitated by these gloomy uncertainties, these wretched waking dreams of grief, the first rays of twilight pierced his windows and shone upon the pale blue paper on which he had just traced his justification of Providence. It was just 5 o'clock in the morning when a slight noise reached his ear, which appeared like a stifled sigh. He turned his head, looked round him, and saw no one, but the sound was repeated distinctly enough to convince him of its reality. He arose, and quietly opening the door of the drawing-room, saw Ade, who had fallen on a chair with her arms hanging down and her beautiful head thrown back. She had been standing at the door to prevent his going out without seeing her, until sleep, which the young cannot resist, had overpowered her frame, wearied as she was with watching so long. The noise of the door did not awaken her, and Monte Cristo gazed at her with affectionate regret. "She remembered she had a son," said he, "and I forgot I had a daughter." Then, shaking his head sorrowfully, "Poor Ade," said he, "she wished to see me, to speak to me. She has feared or guessed something. Oh, I cannot go without taking leave of her. I cannot die without confiding her to someone." He quietly regained his seat and wrote under the other lines: "I bequeath to Maximilian Morel, captain and son of my former patron Pierre Morel, shipowner at Marseille, the sum of 20 millions, a part of which may be offered to his sister Julia and brother-in-law Emmanuel, if he does not fear this increase of fortune may mar their happiness. These 20 millions are concealed in my grotto at Monte Cristo, of which Bertuccio knows the secret. If his heart is free, and he will marry Ade, the daughter of Ali Pasha of Yanina, whom I have brought up with the love of a father, and who has shown the love and tenderness of a daughter for me, he will thus accomplish my last wish. This will has already constituted Ade heiress of the rest of my fortune, consisting in lands, rents on England, Austria, and Holland, furniture in my different palaces and houses, and which, without the 20 millions and the legacies to my servants, may still amount to 60 millions. He was finishing the last line when a cry behind him made him start, and the pen fell from his hand. "Ade," said he, "did you read it?" "Oh, my lord," said she, "why are you writing thus at such an hour? Why are you bequeathing all your fortune to me? Are you going to leave me?" "I am going on a journey, dear child," said Monte Cristo, with an expression of infinite tenderness and melancholy, "and if any misfortune should happen to me..." The count stopped. "Well?" asked the young girl, with an authoritative tone the count had never observed before, and which startled him. "Well, if any misfortune happened to me," replied Monte Cristo, "I wish my daughter to be happy." Ade smiled sorrowfully and shook her head. "Do you think of dying, my lord?" said she. "The wise man has said, it is good to think of death, my child." "Well, if you die," said she, "bequeath your fortune to others, for if you die, I shall require nothing." And taking the paper, she tore it in 4 pieces and threw it in the middle of the room. Then, the effort having exhausted her strength, she fell, not asleep this time, but fainting on the floor. The count leant over her and raised her in his arms, and seeing that sweet face pale, those lovely eyes closed, that beautiful form motionless and to all appearances lifeless, the idea occurred to him for the first time that perhaps she loved him otherwise than a daughter loves a father. Alas, murmured he, with intense suffering, I might then have been happy yet. Then he carried Ade to her room, resigned her to the care of her attendants, and returning to his cabinet, which he shut quickly this time, he again copied the destroyed will. As he was finishing, the sound of a cabriolet entering the yard was heard. Monte Cristo approached the window and saw Maximilian and Emmanuel alight. Good, said he. It was time. And he sealed his will with three seals. One moment afterwards, he heard a noise in the drawing-room and went to open the door himself. Morel was there. He had come 20 minutes before the time appointed. I am, perhaps, come too soon, Count, said he, but I frankly acknowledge I have not closed my eyes all night, nor anyone in my house. I require to see you strong in your courageous assurance to recover myself. Monte Cristo could not resist this proof of affection. He not only extended his hand to the young man, but flew to him with open arms. Morel, said he, it is a happy day for me to feel I am beloved by such a man as you. Good morning, Emmanuel. You will come with me then, Maximilian. Did you doubt it? Said the young captain. But if I were wrong, I watched you during the whole scene of that challenge yesterday. I have been thinking of your firmness all this night, and I said, justice must be on your side, or man's countenance is no longer to be relied on. But, Morel, Albert is your friend, a simple acquaintance, sir. You met on the same day you first saw me, truly, but I should not have recollected it had you not reminded me. Thank you, Morel. Then, ringing the bell once, look, said he to Ali, who came immediately, take that to my solicitor. It is my will, Morel. When I am dead, you will go and examine it. What? Said Morel. You dead? Yes. Must I not be prepared for everything, dear friend? But what did you do yesterday, after you left me? I went to Tortoni, where, as I expected, I found Beauchamp and Château Renaud. I own I was seeking them. Why? When all was arranged. Listen, Count, the affair is serious and unavoidable. Did you doubt it? No. The offence was public, and everyone is already talking of it. Well? Well, I hoped to get an exchange of arms, to substitute the sword for the pistol. The pistol is blind. Have you succeeded? Asked Monte Cristo quickly, with an imperceptible gleam of hope. No, for your skill with the sword is so well known. Ah, who has betrayed me? The skillful swordsman whom you have conquered. And you failed. They positively refused. Morel, said the Count, have you ever seen me fire a pistol? Never. Well, we have time. Look. Monte Cristo took the pistols he held in his hand when Mercedes entered, and fixing an ace of clubs against the iron plate, with four shots he successively shot off the four sides of the club. At each shot, Morel turned pale. He examined the balls with which Monte Cristo performed this dexterous feat, and saw that they were no larger than deer shot. It is astonishing, said he. Look, Emmanuel. Then turning towards Monte Cristo, Count, said he, in the name of all that is dear to you, I entreat you not to kill Albert. The unhappy youth has a mother. You are right, said Monte Cristo, and I have none. These words were uttered in a tone which made Morel shudder. You are the offended party, Count. Doubtless. What does that imply? That you will fire first. I fire first? Oh, I obtained, or rather claimed, that. We had conceded enough for them to yield us that. And at what distance? 20 paces. A terrific smile passed over the Count's lips. Morel, said he, Do not forget what you have just seen. The only chance for Albert's safety, then, will arise from your emotion.
I suffer from emotion, said Monte Cristo,
or from your generosity, my friend. To so good a marksman as you are, I may say what would appear absurd to another.
What is it?
Break his arm, wound him, but do not kill him.
I will tell you, Morel, said the Count, that I do not need entreating to spare the life of Monsieur de Morcerf. He shall be so well spared that he will return quietly with his two friends, while I...
And you?
That's another story.
I shall be carried home.
What do you mean? Cried Maximilian, almost beside himself.
As I told you, my dear Morel, Monsieur de Morcerf will kill me.
Morel looked at the Count as though he could no longer grasp his meaning.
But what has happened, then, since last evening, Count?
The same thing which happened to Brutus the night before the Battle of Philippi. I have seen a phantom, and that phantom told me, Morel, I had lived long enough.
Maximilian and Emmanuel looked at each other. Monte Cristo drew out his watch.
Let us go, said he. It is 7:05, and the appointment was for 8:00.
A carriage was in readiness at the door. Monte Cristo stepped into it with his two friends. He had stopped a moment in the passage to listen at a door, and Maximilian and Emmanuel, who had considerately passed forward a few steps, thought they heard him answer by a sigh, a sob from within. As the clock struck 8, they drove up to the place of meeting.
"We are the first," said Morel, looking out of the window.
"Truly," said Emmanuel, "I perceive two young men down there who are evidently waiting."
Monte Cristo drew Morel not aside, but a step or two behind his brother-in-law.
"Maximilian," said he, "are your affections disengaged?"
Morel looked at Monte Cristo with astonishment.
"I do not seek your confidence, my dear friend. I only ask you a simple question. Answer it. That is all I require."
"I love a young girl, Count."
"Do you love her much?"
"More than my life."
"Another hope defeated," said the Count.
Then, with a sigh,
"Poor Ade," murmured he.
"In truth, Count, if I knew less of you, I should think you were less brave than you are.
Because I sigh when thinking of someone I am leaving?
Come, Morel, it is not like a soldier to be so bad a judge of courage.
Do I regret life? What is it to me who have passed 20 years between life and death?
Moreover, do not alarm yourself, Morel. This weakness, if it is such, is betrayed to you alone. I know the world is a drawing-room from which we must retreat politely and honestly, that is, with a bow, and all debts of honor paid."
"That is to the purpose.
Have you brought your arms?"
"I? What for?"
"I hope those gentlemen have theirs."
"I will inquire," said Morel.
"Do, but make no treaty, you understand me.
You need not fear."
Morel advanced towards Beauchamp and Chateau Renaud, who, seeing his intention, came to meet him. The three young people bowed to each other courteously, if not affably.
"Excuse me, gentlemen," said Morel, "but I do not see Monsieur de Morcerf."
"He sent us word this morning," replied Chateau Renaud, "that he would meet us on the ground."
"Ah," said Morel.
Beauchamp pulled out his watch.
"It is only 8:05. Said he to Morel. "There is not much time lost yet."
"Oh, I made no allusion of that kind," replied Morel.
"There is a carriage coming," said Chateau Renaud. It advanced rapidly along one of the avenues leading towards the open space where they were assembled.
"You are doubtless provided with pistols, gentlemen. Monsieur de Monte Cristo yields his right of using his."
"We had anticipated this kindness on the part of the Count," said Beauchamp, "and I have brought some arms which I bought 8 or 10 days since, thinking to want them on a similar occasion. They are quite new and have not yet been used. Will you examine them?
Oh, Monsieur Beauchamp, if you assure me Monsieur de Morcerf does not know these arms, you may readily believe your word will be quite sufficient.
Gentlemen, said Chateau Renaud, it is not Morcerf coming in that carriage. Faith, it is France and Debray.
The two young men he announced were indeed approaching.
What chance brings you here, gentlemen? Said Chateau Renaud, shaking hands with each of them.
Because, said Debray, Albert sent this morning to request us to come.
Beauchamp and Chateau Renaud exchanged looks of astonishment.
I think I understand his reason, said Morel.
What is it?
Yesterday afternoon I received a letter from Monsieur de Morcerf, begging me to attend the opera.
And I, said Debray.
And I also, said France.
And we too, added Beauchamp and Chateau Renaud. Having wished you all to witness the challenge, he now wishes you to be present at the combat.
Exactly so, said the young men. You have probably guessed right.
But after all these arrangements, he does not come himself, said Chateau Renaud. Albert is 10 minutes after time.
There he comes, said Beauchamp, on horseback at full gallop, followed by a servant.
How imprudent, said Chateau Renaud, to come on horseback to fight with the pistol, after all the instructions I had given him.
And besides, said Beauchamp, with a collar above his cravat, an open coat and white waistcoat, why has he not painted a spot upon his heart? It would have been more simple.
Meanwhile, Albert had arrived within 10 paces of the group formed by the 5 young men. He jumped from his horse, threw the bridle on his servant's arm, and joined them. He was pale, and his eyes were red and swollen. It was evident he had not slept. A shade of melancholy gravity overspread his countenance, which was not natural to him.
I thank you, gentlemen, said he, for having complied with my request. I feel extremely grateful for this mark of friendship.
Morel had stepped back as Morcerf approached, and remained at a short distance.
And to you also, Monsieur Morel, my thanks are due. Come, there cannot be too many.
Sir, said Maximilian, you are not perhaps aware I am Monsieur de Monte Cristo's friend.
I was not sure, but I expected it.
So much the better. The more honorable men there are here, the better I shall be satisfied.
Monsieur Morel, said Chateau Renaud, will you apprise the Count of Monte Cristo that Monsieur de Morcerf is arrived and we are at his command?
Morel was preparing to fulfill his commission. Beauchamp had meanwhile drawn the box of pistols from the carriage.
Stop, gentlemen, said Albert. I have 2 words to say to the Count of Monte Cristo.
In private? Asked Morel.
No, sir. Before all who are here.
Albert's witnesses looked at each other. France and Debray exchanged some words in a whisper, and Morel, rejoiced at this unexpected incident, went to fetch the Count, who was walking in a retired path with Emmanuel.
What does he want with me? Said Monte Cristo.
I do not know, but he wishes to speak to you.
Ah, said Monte Cristo. I trust he is not going to tempt me by some fresh insult.
I do not think such is his intention, said Morel.
The Count advanced, accompanied by Maximilian and Emmanuel. His calm and serene look formed a singular contrast to Albert's grief-stricken face, who approached also, followed by the 4 young people.
When at 3 paces distant, Albert and the Count stopped.
Approach, gentlemen, said Albert.
I wish you not to lose 1 word of what I am about to have the honor of saying to the Count of Monte Cristo, for it must be repeated by you to all who will listen to it, strange as it may appear to you.
Proceed, sir, said the Count.
Sir, said Albert, at first with a tremulous voice, but which gradually became firmer, I reproached you with exposing the conduct of Monsieur de Morcerf in Epirus, for, guilty as I knew he was, I thought you had no right to punish him, but I have since learned you have that right. It is not Fernand Mondego's treachery towards Ali Pasha which induces me so readily to excuse you, but the treachery of the fisherman Fernand towards you, and the almost unheard-of miseries which were its consequences. And I say and proclaim it publicly that you were justified in revenging yourself on my father, and I, his son, thank you for not using greater severity." Had a thunderbolt fallen in the midst of the spectators of this unexpected scene, it would not have surprised them more than did Albert's declaration. As for Monte Cristo, his eyes slowly rose towards heaven with an expression of infinite gratitude. He could not understand how Albert's fiery nature, of which he had seen so much among the Roman bandits, had suddenly stooped to this humiliation. He recognized the influence of Mercedes and saw why her noble heart had not opposed the sacrifice she knew beforehand would be useless. "Now, sir," said Albert, "if you think my apology sufficient, pray give me your hand. Next to the merit of infallibility which you appear to possess, I rank that of candidly acknowledging a fault. But this confession concerns me only. I acted well as a man, but you have acted better than man. An angel alone could have saved one of us from death. That angel came from heaven, if not to make us friends, which, alas, fatality renders impossible, at least to make us esteem each other." Monte Cristo, with moistened eye, heaving breast and lips half open, extended to Albert a hand which the latter pressed with a sentiment resembling respectful fear. "Gentlemen," said he, "Monsieur de Monte Cristo receives my apology. I had acted hastily towards him. Hasty actions are generally bad ones. Now my fault is repaired. I hope the world will not call me cowardly for acting as my conscience dictated. But if anyone should entertain a false opinion of me," added he, drawing himself up as if he would challenge both friends and enemies, "I shall endeavor to correct his mistake."
"What has then happened during the night?" asked Beauchamp to Chateau Renaud. "We appear to make a very sorry figure here."
"In truth, what Albert has just done is either very despicable or very noble," replied the Baron.
"What can it mean?" said Debray to France. "The Count of Monte Cristo acts dishonorably to Monsieur de Morcerf and is justified by his son. Had I 10 Janinas in my family, I should only consider myself the more bound to fight 10 times."
As for Monte Cristo, his head was bent down, his arms were powerless. Bowing under the weight of 24 years' reminiscences, he thought not of Albert, of Beauchamp, of Chateau Renaud, or of any of that group. But he thought of that courageous woman who had come to plead for her son's life, to whom he had offered his, and who had now saved it by the revelation of a dreadful family secret capable of destroying for ever in that young man's heart every feeling of filial piety. "Providence still," murmured he. "Now only am I fully convinced of being the emissary of God." 92. The Mother and Son. The Count of Monte Cristo bowed to the five young people with a melancholy and dignified smile, and got into his carriage with Maximilian and Emmanuel. Albert, Beauchamp, and Chateau Renaud remained alone. The young man's look at his two friends, without being timid, appeared to ask their opinion of what he had just done.
"Indeed, my dear friend," said Beauchamp first, who had either the most feeling or the least dissimulation, "allow me to congratulate you. This is a very unhoped-for conclusion of a very disagreeable affair."
Albert remained silent and wrapped in thought. Chateau Renaud contented himself with tapping his boot with his flexible cane.
"Are we not going?" said he, after this embarrassing silence. "When you please," replied Beauchamp. "Allow me only time to compliment Monsieur de Morcerf, who has given proof today of such chivalric generosity, so rare.
Oh, yes, said Chateau Renaud.
It is magnificent, continued Beauchamp, to be able to exercise so much self-control.
Assuredly. As for me, I should have been incapable of it, said Chateau Renaud, with most significant coolness. Gentlemen, interrupted Albert, I think you did not understand that something very serious had passed between Monsieur de Monte Cristo and myself.
Possibly, possibly, said Beauchamp immediately, but every simpleton would not be able to understand your heroism, and sooner or later you will find yourself compelled to explain it to them more energetically than would be convenient to your bodily health and the duration of your life. May I give you a friendly counsel? Set out for Naples, The Hague, or St. Petersburg, calm countries where the point of honor is better understood than among our hot-headed Parisians. Seek quietude and oblivion so that you may return peaceably to France after a few years. Am I not right, Monsieur de Chateau Renaud?
That is quite my opinion, said the gentleman. Nothing induces serious duels so much as a fruitless one. Thank you, gentlemen, replied Albert with a smile of indifference. I shall follow your advice, not because you gave it, but because I had before intended to quit France. I thank you equally for the service you have rendered me in being my seconds. It is deeply engraved on my heart, since, after what you have just said, I remember that only. Chateau Renaud and Beauchamp looked at each other. The impression was the same on both of them, and the tone in which Morcerf had just expressed his thanks was so determined that the position would have become embarrassing for all if the conversation had continued.
Farewell, Albert, said Beauchamp suddenly, carelessly extending his hand to the young man, without the latter appearing to rouse from his lethargy. In fact, he did not notice the offered hand.
Farewell, said Chateau Renaud in his turn, keeping the little cane in his left hand and saluting with his right. Albert's lips scarcely whispered farewell, but his look was more explicit. It embraced a whole poem of restrained anger, proud disdain, and generous indignation. He preserved his melancholy and motionless position for some time after his two friends had regained their carriage. Then, suddenly loosing his horse from the little tree to which his servant had fastened it, he sprang on it and galloped off in the direction of Paris. In a quarter of an hour he was entering the hotel of the Rue du Eld. As he alighted, he thought he saw behind the curtain of the Count's bedroom his father's pale face. Albert turned away his head with a sigh and went to his own apartments. He cast one lingering look on all the luxuries which had rendered life so easy and so happy since his infancy. He looked at the pictures whose faces seemed to smile, and the landscapes which appeared painted in brighter colors. Then he took away his mother's portrait with its oaken frame, leaving the gilt frame from which he took it black and empty. Then he arranged all his beautiful Turkish arms, his fine English guns, his Japanese china, his cups mounted in silver, his artistic bronzes signed Fouché or Barye, examined the cupboards and placed the key in each, threw into a drawer of his secretaire, which he left open, all the pocket money he had about him, and with it the 1,000 fancy jewels from his vases and his jewel boxes, made an exact inventory of all, and placed it in the most conspicuous part of the table, after putting aside the books and papers which encumbered it. At the commencement of this work, his servant, notwithstanding his prohibition, came to his room. "What do you want?" asked he, with a more sorrowful than angry tone. "Pardon me, sir," replied the valet. "You had forbidden me to disturb you, but the Count of Morcerf had called me."
"Well," said Albert, "I did not like to go to him without first seeing you."
"Why?" "Because the Count is doubtless aware
that I accompanied you to the meeting this morning.
It is probable, said Albert, and since he has sent for me, it is doubtless to question me on what happened there.
What must I answer?
The truth.
Then I shall say the duel did not take place.
You will say I apologized to the Count of Monte Cristo.
Go.
The valet bowed and retired, and Albert returned to his inventory.
As he was finishing this work, the sound of horses prancing in the yard and the wheels of a carriage shaking his window attracted his attention. He approached the window and saw his father get into it, and it drove away. The door was scarcely closed when Albert bent his steps to his mother's room, and no one being there to announce him, he advanced to her bedroom, and, distressed by what he saw and guessed, stopped for one moment at the door. As if the same soul had animated these two beings, Mercedes was doing the same in her apartments as he had just done. Everything was in order. Laces, dresses, jewels, linen, money, all were arranged in the drawers, and the Countess was carefully collecting the keys. Albert saw all these preparations. He understood them, and exclaiming, "My mother!" he threw his arms round her neck. The artist who could have depicted the expression of these two countenances would certainly have made of them a beautiful picture. All these proofs of an energetic resolution, which Albert did not fear on his own account, alarmed him for his mother.
"What are you doing?" asked he.
"What were you doing?" replied she.
"Oh, my mother!" exclaimed Albert, so overcome he could scarcely speak. "It is not the same with you and me. You cannot have made the same resolution I have, for I am come to warn you that I bid adieu to your house and to you."
"I also," replied Mercedes, "am going, and I acknowledge I had depended on your accompanying me. Have I deceived myself?"
"My mother," said Albert with firmness, "I cannot make you share the fate I have planned for myself. I must live henceforth without rank and fortune, and to begin this hard apprenticeship, I must borrow from a friend the loaf I shall eat until I have earned one. So, my dear mother, I am going at once to ask France to lend me the small sum I shall require to supply my present wants.
You, my poor child, suffer poverty and hunger?
Oh, say not so. It will break my resolutions, but not mine, mother," replied Albert. "I am young and strong. I believe I am courageous, and since yesterday I have learned the power of will. Alas, my dear mother, some have suffered so much and yet live, and have raised a new fortune on the ruin of all the promises of happiness which heaven had made them, on the fragments of all the hope which God had given them.
I have seen that, my mother. I know that from the gulf in which their enemies have plunged them, they have risen with so much vigor and glory that in their turn they have ruled their former conquerors and have punished them. No, my mother, from this moment I have done with the past and accept nothing from it, not even a name, because you can understand your son cannot bear the name of a man who ought to blush before another."
"Albert, my child," said Mercedes, "if I had a stronger heart, that is the counsel I would have given you. Your conscience has spoken when my voice became too weak. Listen to its dictates. You had friends, Albert. Break off their acquaintance, but do not despair. You have life before you, my dear Albert, for you are yet scarcely 22 years old, and as a pure heart like yours wants a spotless name, take my father's. It was Herrera. I am sure, my Albert, whatever may be your career, you will soon render that name illustrious. Then, my friend, return to the world still more brilliant from the reflection of your former sorrows. And if I am wrong, still let me cherish these hopes, for I have no future to look forward to. For me,
A grave opens when I pass the threshold of this house. I will fulfill all your wishes, my dear mother, said the young man. Yes, I share your hopes. The anger of heaven will not pursue us, you so pure and I so innocent. But since our resolution is formed, let us act promptly. Monsieur de Morcerf went out about half an hour since. The opportunity is favorable to avoid an explanation. I am ready, my son, said Mercedes. Albert ran to fetch a hackney coach. He recollected there was a small furnished house to let in the Rue des Saints-Pères, where his mother would find a humble but decent lodging, and thither he intended conducting the countess. As the hackney coach stopped at the door, and Albert was alighting, a man approached and gave him a letter. Albert recognized the bearer. "From the Count," said Bertuccio. Albert took the letter, opened it and read it, then looked round for Bertuccio, but he was gone. He returned to Mercedes with tears in his eyes and heaving breast, and without uttering a word, he gave her the letter. Mercedes read, "Albert, while showing you that I have discovered your plans, I hope also to convince you of my delicacy. You are free. You leave the Count's hotel, and you take your mother to your home. But reflect. Albert, you owe her more than your poor noble heart can pay her. Keep the struggle for yourself. Bear all the suffering, but spare her the trial of poverty which must accompany your first efforts. For she deserves not even the shadow of the misfortune which has this day fallen on her, and Providence wills not the innocent should suffer for the guilty. I know you are going to leave the Rue du Eld without taking anything with you. Do not seek to know how I discovered it. I know it. That is sufficient. Now listen, Albert. 24 years ago I returned proud and joyful to my country. I had a betrothed, Albert, a lovely girl whom I adored, and I was bringing to my betrothed 150 louis, painfully amassed by ceaseless toil. This money was for her. I destined it for her, and knowing the treachery of the sea, I buried our treasure in the little garden of the house my father lived in at Marseille on the Allée des Meilleurs. Your mother, Albert, knows that poor house well. A short time since, I passed through Marseille, and went to see the old house, which revived so many painful recollections, and in the evening I took a spade and dug in the corner of the garden where I had concealed my treasure. The iron box was there. No one had touched it. It was under a beautiful fig tree my father had planted the day I was born, which overshadowed the spot. Well, Albert, this money, which was formerly designed to promote the comfort and tranquillity of the woman I adored, may now, from a strange and painful circumstance, be devoted to the same purpose. Oh, feel for me, who could offer millions to that poor woman, but who return her only the piece of black bread forgotten under my poor roof since the day I was torn from her I loved. You are a generous man, Albert, but perhaps you may be blinded by pride or resentment. If you refuse me, if you ask another for what I have a right to offer you, I will say it is ungenerous of you to refuse the life of your mother at the hands of a man whose father was allowed to die in all the horrors of poverty and despair by your father. Albert stood pale and motionless to hear what his mother would decide after she had finished reading this letter. Mercedes turned her eyes with an ineffable look towards heaven. "I accept it," said she. "He has a right to pay the dowry, which I shall take with me to some convent." Putting the letter in her bosom, she took her son's arm, and with a firmer step than she even herself expected, she went downstairs. 93. The Suicide. Meanwhile, Monte Cristo had also returned to town with Emmanuel and Maximilian, Their return was cheerful. Emmanuel did not conceal his joy at having seen peace succeed to war, and acknowledged aloud his philanthropic tastes. Morel, in a corner of the carriage, allowed his brother-in-law's gaiety to expend itself in words, while he felt equal inward joy, which, however, betrayed itself